as the ordinary world went on. The children at play, James and Simon hewing wood in the workshop, Mary and my sisters-in-law kneading dough near the oven. The day in its courses. My breath hovered painfully over a flame at the back of my throat. Joanna is certain Antipas will act?
He will act, Anna, there's little doubt of it. King Aretas is mobilizing for war to avenge his daughter. Her escape has set off a cataclysm, and Antipas lays blame on everyone who abetted his first wife, including you. To make matters worse, Herodias learned that her new husband was once fascinated by you, that he commissioned the mosaic of your face. Joanna told me this as well, and I suspect it was she herself who divulged the information to Herodias as a way of gaining her favor. Herodias is pressing Antipas to arrest you as he did John. I tell you, she will see it done. Jesus had been unaccountably silent. He covered my hand with his and squeezed. He and Judas had been displeased when I'd sent the warning to Phasaelus. I tried now to imagine myself not sending it. I couldn't. With that realization, the fear began to leave my body. There was an incongruous peace in my helplessness, in the knowledge that what was done and could not be undone. And even if I could change it, I wouldn't. I'm sorry, Judas said to me. I should never have agreed to deliver your message.
I don't wish to question the past, I said.
You're right, little sister. We must think of the future and do so quickly. Joanna believed Antipas's soldiers would be coming for you in a matter of days. I walked here quickly, but Antipas's soldiers will come on horseback. They may have been dispatched by now. There's little time. Jesus sat forward. I expected him to say we should go and hide in the Judean hills, as he'd done when John was arrested. It would mean great difficulty, and who knew how long we would have to remain out there in that forsaken wilderness. But what choice was there? He spoke with firm, measured words. You must go to Alexandria with your aunt. The day was warm, lemon-yellow light brimming, and still a chill swept over me. Couldn't we hide in the wilderness as you did before? You will not be safe even there, he said. Desperation took hold. I'd been nearly 6 months without him, and the thought of separating again was excruciating. We could go together to Syria, to Caesarea Philippi, to Decapolis. Antipas has no jurisdiction in those places. Jesus' eyes were afloat with sadness. My time has come, Anna. I must take up my ministry in Galilee in the wake of John's movement. It cannot wait. Alexandria. It will be temporary, Jesus said. You should remain in Egypt with your uncle Haran until Antipas's anger and vengeance has cooled. We'll send a letter to you there when it's safe to return. I stared at him, finally stammering. But that could be months, a year even. I hate to think of being separated from you, he said, but you will be safe, and I can carry on my ministry. When you return, you can join me. Yaltha placed her hand on my cheek. She said, your husband is right. Tomorrow we'll go to Alexandria, you and I. Jesus has his destiny. Let him fulfill it. You have your destiny too. Is this not what Sophia wanted all along? Lavi joined our conclave beneath the olive branches, and we sat for what seemed like hours, conspiring. The plan was sealed. At daybreak, Judas would walk with us to Sepphoris, deliver us to Apion, then travel on with us to Caesarea to see us safely aboard the ship to Alexandria. Jesus had wanted to escort us, but I'd been adamant. I do not want you to miss your sister's wedding, I told him. It was only days away, nor do I wish to prolong our goodbye. Let's say farewell here in the place where we've spent these 11 years together. I spoke the truth to my husband, but not all the truth. Convincing Apion to take me to Alexandria, and Lavi as well, for he'd begged to accompany us, and I meant to bargain for his passage too, would require another act of bribery, and I didn't wish Jesus to witness it. When we finally dispersed from beneath the tree, I pulled Judas aside into the storeroom and told him about trading mother's jewelry for coins. He made no grimace of disapproval. My brother had stolen plenty from the rich to fund his sedition. I'm certain Apion will consent to take me and Lavi to Alexandria For a bribe of 2,000 drachma, I said. If so, that will leave us with 3,000. Jesus needs a patron to finance his ministry. I wish to divide the remaining money between myself and him. The amount could fund his work for months, perhaps the entire time I'm away. I want you to safeguard his portion, Judas, and you must never tell him where it came from. Promise me. He balked a little. How will I explain it? He will press me to know his patron. Tell him it's someone in Tiberias. Tell him Joanna sent the coins out of gratitude for our part in saving her mistress. Tell him it's anonymous. I don't care. Only don't reveal my part in it. He's my friend, Anna. I believe in what he's doing. Jesus is our best hope to find freedom from Rome. I don't wish to start out lying to him. I hate lying to him too, but I fear he won't take the money otherwise. I'll do as you ask, but let it be known. When it comes to you, I'm too indulgent. One more thing, then, I said. You must write to me. Set aside some of the coins to purchase parchments and hire messengers. Send me news of Jesus and summon me as soon as it's safe to return. Swear it. He hugged me to him. I swear it. 32. I dug my incantation bowl from the bottom of the cedar chest, where it had lain neglected and fallow for years. It was the size of a dough bowl, too large for my travel pouch, but I would not leave it behind. Nor my scrolls. When the silver coins were emptied from the large pouch, I would slip the bowl and the scrolls into it. Until then, I would carry them in my arms. I gazed at the wool sack of pot shards on which I'd penned the verses of grief for Susanna. They would have to stay behind. The afternoon had given way to evening dark. Out in the courtyard, hushed voices. From the doorway, I could see Jesus and his family. In the sky, one lone star, a puncture of light. "Your wife has acted recklessly," I heard James say. "Now she will bring Antipas's soldiers to our door." "What are we to say to them?" Simon said. Jesus clasped a hand on each of their shoulders, the way he had of reminding them they were all brothers. "Tell them the woman they seek no longer lives here. Tell them she has left me and gone away with her brother. We don't know where." "You would have us lie to them?" James asked. Jesus' suggestion that they prevaricate about my whereabouts surprised me too. Mary had been standing on the periphery, but she stepped before James and Simon. "What Jesus would have you do is help him preserve the life of his wife," she said sharply. "You will do as he asks of you." "We must do as our conscience requires," said Simon. Salome made a whimpering sound, a sigh, a cry. I couldn't tell. "Let us drink some wine and talk together," Jesus said. I closed the door. In the stillness, a great heaviness came over me. I lit the lamps. Jesus would be back soon. Hurriedly, I cleansed my face and hands, donned a clean white garment, and smoothed my hair with oil fragrant with cloves. Yatha's words returned to me. "You have your destiny, too." They stirred the old longings in me, the terrible need for my own life. I reopened my chest and retrieved the last of the oven ink, half full and thick with gum, then pulled a reed pen from my travel pouch. Cross-writing in quick tiny letters between the lines of my old prayer, I wrote a new prayer inside my incantation bowl. "Sophia, breath of God, set my eyes on Egypt. Once the land of bondage, let it become the land of freedom. Deliver me to the place of papyri and ink, to the place I will be born." 33. I woke before daybreak with my head burrowed in the crook of Jesus's neck. His beard brushed my forehead. Heat radiated from his skin with the scent of wine and salt. I didn't move. I lay in the dark and drank him in. The light came slow and limping, never fully arriving. Overhead, thunder, a splintering sound, then another and another, the sky timbers cracking. Jesus stirred, making a soft, droning noise with his lips. I thought he would get up then and pray. Instead, he said, "Little thunder, Is that you I hear? And he laughed. I forced a lilt into my voice, teasing him back. It's me, beloved. I'm roaring at the thought of leaving you behind. He turned on his side to face me, and I felt that he saw deep inside me. He said, I bless the largeness in you, Anna. And I bless yours, I told him. Then he rose and, opening the door, stared toward the valley with the same deep, pure gaze he'd cast on me. I went to stand beside him and looked in the same direction as he, and it seemed for an instant I saw the world as he did, orphaned and broken and staggeringly beautiful, a thing to be held and put back right. Parting was fully upon us now. I wished with all my being that we might have gone on together. We ate in silence. After I dressed and made myself ready for the journey ahead, I opened the goatskin pouch that held the red thread. It was fragile, the thinnest of filaments, but I would wear it this day for him. He helped me tie it onto my wrist. The family waited in the courtyard. I embraced each of them before Jesus walked with me to the gate, where Judas, Yalfa, and Lavi waited. The drizzle had stopped, but the sky was sodden. We didn't linger with goodbyes. I kissed Jesus' mouth. May this severing not cut us apart, but bind us together, I said. And holding my bowl and my scrolls to my chest, I set my face toward Egypt. Alexandria. Lake Mareotis, Egypt. 28-30 CE. 1. We sailed into the great harbor of Alexandria after 8 days of turbulent seas. Though our ship, a vessel that bore Egyptian corn to Caesarea and returned to Alexandria with olives, had hugged the coastline, the waves had left me unable to keep down food or drink. Throughout the journey, I had lain curled on my mat below decks and thought of Jesus. At times, my distress at traveling farther and farther away from him was so great, I wondered if my sickness wasn't from the pitch of the sea at all, but from the pain and tumult of leaving him. Still weak and nauseated, I forced myself to leave the ship's hull for my first glimpse of the city I'd dreamed about since Yalfa first began telling me stories of her greatness. Standing beside my aunt, I inhaled the foggy air and drew my coat to my neck, the clamor of the mainsail snapping ferociously over our heads. The harbor swarmed with ships, large merchant ships like ours, and smaller fleet galleys. There, said my aunt, pointing into the gloom, there's Pharos, the great lighthouse. When I turned, I was met by a spectacle I couldn't have imagined. On a small island facing the harbor, a massive tower of white marble rose in 3 grand tiers toward the clouds, and at the top a magnificent blaze of light. Even the temple in Jerusalem couldn't compare to it. How do they make such a light? I murmured, too awed to realize I'd spoken the thought aloud. The fire is reflected by massive bronze mirrors, Yalfa replied, and I saw in her face the pride she felt for her city. A statue crowned the pinnacle of the lighthouse dome, a man pointing skyward. Who's that? I asked. Helios, the Greek sun god. See? He's pointing to the sun. The city brimmed along the waterfront, shining white buildings that stretched into the distance. My nausea forgotten, I stared transfixed at one of them that jutted out into the harbor, a dazzling edifice that seemed to float on the water's surface. Behold, Yalfa said, watching my face, the palace of the royals. I once told you about the queen who lived there, Cleopatra VII, the one who went to Rome with Caesar. Yalfa laughed. Yes, that, among other things. She died the year I was born. I grew up hearing stories of her. My father, your grandfather, said she would write on nothing but papyrus, made in our family's workshops. She proclaimed it the finest papyrus in Egypt. Before I could take in the news that Cleopatra had made reference to my family, an imposing columned structure loomed up. That's one of the temples to Isis, Yalfa said. There's a grander one near the library known as Isis Medica that houses a medical school. My mind had become dizzy with wonder. How alien this place was. How gloriously alien.
We grew silent, letting the city slide past like the contours of a dream, and I thought of my beloved, of how far I was from him. By now he would have attended Salome's wedding in Cana and departed for Capernaum to assemble his followers and start his ministry. The memory of him standing at a gate when I departed brought a twist of pain. I longed to be with him. But not in Galilee. No, not there. Here. When I looked again at Yaltha, her eyes were misted, whether from wind, happiness, or her own twist of pain for Chaya, I couldn't say. When we disembarked, Apian hired a flat-roofed litter for the four of us, with curtained windows and cushioned seats, pulled by two donkeys. We bobbed along the Canopic Way, the main corridor of the city, a cobblestone street so wide it could fit 50 litters side by side. The street was lined on either side with red-roofed buildings and people milling about, women with uncovered heads, and girls, not just boys, trotting behind their tutors with wooden tablets hitched to their waists on cords. Catching sight of a brilliantly hued Egyptian woman, winged and kneeling, painted inside a portico, I made an exclamation of surprise, and Yaltha leaned to me and said, "Winged Isis, you'll see her everywhere." We came upon a line of horse-drawn chariots driven by men in helmets, who, Apian informed us, were on their way to the Hippodrome. A resplendent-looking pediment suddenly protruded in the distance. My heart gave a lurch. I couldn't see the building's facade, but the roof seemed to preside over the city. "Is that the great library?" I asked Yaltha. "It is," she said. "We will go there, you and I." During our voyage, my aunt had described how the library's 500,000 scrolls were meticulously catalogued and arranged, all the texts in existence in the entire world. She'd told me of the scholars who lived there, how they'd determined the earth was round, and measured not only its circumference, but its distance to the sun. And we would go there. It was not until our litter arrived at Haran's house that my excitement turned to apprehension. I had lied to Apian, insisting Haran had sent a letter giving his permission for Yaltha to come. How could my deceit possibly remain undiscovered? What if Haran refused to take us in? I couldn't be elsewhere. Judas would send his letters to Haran's house. Before we'd boarded the ship in Caesarea, I'd made certain that Apian conveyed to my brother exactly how the dispatches should be addressed. "Haran ben Philip Levius, Jewish quarter, Alexandria," he'd said. "Is that all that's needed?" I asked. "Your uncle is the wealthiest Jew in Alexandria," he said. "Everyone knows where he lives." At this, Yaltha dispensed a grunt of derision, causing Apian to cut his eyes toward her. She will have to hide her bitterness better than this, I thought, as we stepped into Haran's palatial house. How would she find Chaya without Haran's help? My uncle looked like my father, lumpy bald head, large ears, thick chest, and beardless. Only his eyes were different, less curious and with a hawkish, praying quality. He met us in the atrium, where an oculus streamed light from the ceiling. He was standing directly beneath it in an unrelenting white shine. I could find no shadow in the room. This struck me as an ominous sign. Yaltha approached him slowly with her face downcast. I was shocked to see her enact an elaborate bow. "Esteemed brother," she said, "I've come home humbled. I beg you to receive me." I shouldn't have worried. She knew very well how to play this game. He glared at her, arms folded. "You've come unbidden, Yaltha. When I sent you to our brother in Galilee, it was with the understanding you would not return." Haran turned to Apian then. "I gave you no authority to bring them here." The revelation of my deception had come sooner than I'd anticipated. "Sir, forgive me," Apian said, his mouth sputtering words. "The younger woman said..." He glanced at me, sweat forming on his temples, and I saw his dilemma. He feared that if he accused me, I would expose the bribes he'd taken. Reading the situation, Haran said, "Is it possible, Apian, that you were bribed? If so, hand the money over to me now, and I'll consider keeping you as my treasurer." It came to me that I should save him. It appeared we would be cast out either way, and I decided to risk everything to win Apian's friendship. I stepped forward. "I am Anna, the daughter of Matthias. Don't blame your employee for bringing us here. We gave him no bribe. Rather, I led him to believe you'd sent a letter with consent for us to come and stay with you. His only fault was having faith in my word. Yaltha glanced at me, uncertain. Lavi shifted on his feet. I didn't look at Apion, but I heard the outbreath that escaped his lips. Haran said, "You stand here and confess you are in my house out of trickery?" He broke into laughter, and there was not a hint of derision in it. "Why have you come here?" "As you know, uncle, my father is dead. My aunt and I had nowhere else to go." "Have you no husband?" he asked. I should have anticipated such an obvious question, but it caught me by surprise. I hesitated too long. "Her husband sent her away," Yaltha said, rescuing me. "She's ashamed to speak of it." "Yes," I muttered. "He turned me out." Then, lest Haran inquire what terrible thing I'd done to deserve my expulsion, I quickly continued. "We traveled here with our guardian because you are my father's eldest brother and our patriarch. My trickery came from my desire to come here and serve you. I ask your forgiveness." He turned to Yaltha. "She's shrewd, this one. I cannot help but like her. Now, tell me, long-lost sister, why have you returned after all this time? Don't tell me that you too have come hoping to serve me. I know better." "I have no wish to serve you, it's true. I wished to come home, that's all. I've been in exile for 12 years. Is that not long enough?" His lips curled. "So you've not returned in hopes of finding your daughter? Any mother would wish to be reunited with a lost daughter before she dies." He was not just ruthless, but perceptive. I told myself I should never underestimate him. "My daughter was adopted long ago," Yaltha said. "I forfeited her. I have no false hope of seeing her again. If you wish to tell me her whereabouts, I would welcome it, but I've made my peace with our separation." He said, "I know nothing of her whereabouts, as you fully know. Her family insisted on a legal agreement that prevents us from having any contact with them." "As I said, she's gone," Yaltha reiterated. "I didn't come for her, only for myself. Let me come home, Haran." How contrite she looked, how convincing. Haran stepped away from the harsh shaft of light and paced, hands clasped behind him. He gave Apion a wave of dismissal, and his treasurer nearly broke into a run as he left the room. My uncle stopped in front of me. "You will pay me 500 bronze drachma for each month you stay under my roof." 500? I was in possession of 1,500 Herodian silver drachma, with no idea how that translated into Egyptian bronze. We needed the money to last up to a year, not just for rent, but for passage home. 100, I said. 400, he countered. 150, and I will serve you as a scribe. A scribe? He snorted. I have a scribe. Does your scribe write Aramaic, Greek, Hebrew, and Latin? All four? I asked. Does he create lettering and script so beautiful people attribute even greater import to the words? Said Yaltha. You do these things? Haran said to me. I do. All right. 150 bronze drachma and your services as a scribe. I require nothing further except that neither of you leave this house. You can't mean to confine us here, I said. This was a blow worse than the cost of his rent. If you require goods from the market, your guardian, as you call him, can do your bidding. He faced Yaltha. As you know, charges of murder do not expire. If I learn that either of you have left the house or made inquiries about your daughter, I'll make sure you're arrested. His face hardened. Chaya's family doesn't want your meddling, and I won't risk them suing me because of it. He clanged a tiny gong, and a young woman, not Jewish, but a long-necked Egyptian with heavily lined eyes, appeared. Show them to the women's quarters and put their guardian with the servants, Haran told her, then abruptly left us. We followed behind her, listening to the shuffle of her sandals on the tile, watching her black hair swish back and forth. We were, it seemed, to be captives here. Does Haran not have a wife we could appeal to? I whispered to Yaltha. She died before I left Alexandria. I don't know if he took another, she whispered back. The servant girl stopped before a doorway. You will reside here, she said to us in broken Greek, then added, he has no wife. No one lives beneath this roof but Haran and his servants. What good ears you have, I said. All servants have good ears, she replied, and I saw Lavi grin. Where are Haran's sons? Yaltha asked. They manage his lands in the Nile Delta. She motioned to Lavi and sauntered off, swaying hair, swaying hips. He gazed at her with parted lips before fumbling after her. My sleeping chamber was separated from Yaltha's by a sitting room that opened onto a courtyard garden, a tiny forest of date palms. We stood in the doorway looking out at it. Haran doesn't trust you, I said. He knows exactly why you're here.
Yes, he knows.
But it's strange, isn't it, that he goes to such lengths to keep you from Chaya, even confining us to the house? What harm would it be for you to see her? Perhaps there is some legal agreement with her family, but I wonder if he conceals Chaya from you only to punish you. Could his need for vengeance be as strong as that? The rumors surrounding my husband's death were a disgrace for him, his own sister believed to be a murderer. He lost business over it. He lost favor in the city. He was shamed. He never got over it, and he has never stopped blaming me. His need for revenge is bottomless. We stood there silent a few moments, and I thought I saw something come into her face, some awareness. She said, what if Haran conceals Chaya not only out of vengeance, but to hide some wrongdoing of his own? My skin prickled. What do you mean, Aunt? I'm not sure, she said. Time will tell us. Out in the center of the garden, a little pond overflowed with blue lotus. At least we have lodging here, I thought. While Yaltha settled herself, I stepped outside and went to kneel beside the pond. As I examined the odd way the lotus grew from the mud at the bottom, I heard footsteps. Turning, I found Apion standing behind me. I'm grateful, he said. You rescued me, at your own expense. I could do no less. He smiled. So, niece of Haran, what is it you want from me? Time will grant us an answer, I said. 2. I spent my mornings in Haran's small scriptorium, making copies of his business records. A fool possesses one copy, he'd said. A wise man, too. My uncle owned his father's lucrative papyrus fields, the transactions of which were acutely boring. Contracts, deeds, accounts, receipts. Mountainous piles of dullness. Fortunately, he still sat on the council of 71 elders that oversaw Jewish affairs in the city, which provided me with far more engaging documents. I copied a wonderful array of lurid complaints about pregnant widows, daughters-in-law found not to be virgins, husbands beating wives, wives deserting husbands. There was an oath from a woman charged with adultery, who swore her innocence in such insistent terms it made me smile, and another from a rabbi's wife claiming a male bath attendant had scalded her thighs with hot water. Most amazing of all was a daughter's petition to give her own self in marriage rather than allow her father to do it. How dull Nazareth had been. I wrote on the most beautiful papyri I'd ever beheld, white, close-grained, polished sheets, and I learned how to gum them together to create rolls twice as long as I was tall. Haran's other scribe was an elderly man named Thaddeus, who had sprigs of white hair in his ears and ink stains on his fingertips, who fell asleep each day holding his pen. Emboldened by his naps, I abandoned my work as well and resumed writing my stories of the matriarchs while he slept. I didn't fear Haran's sudden appearance, for he spent his days flitting about the city, if not attending council meetings, then business at the synagogue or Greek games at the amphitheater. And when he was home, we stayed clear of him, taking meals in our quarters. It was only necessary that I produce slightly more copies than slow, snoring Thaddeus. In this way, I composed the stories of Judith, Ruth, Miriam, Deborah, and Jezebel. I tucked the scrolls inside a large stone jar in my room, adding them to the others. I spent the afternoons in our guest quarters, idling endlessly and fretting for my beloved, whom I pictured wandering about Galilee speaking openly with lepers and harlots and mamzers of every sort, calling for the mighty to be brought low, all of this in the presence of Antipas's spies. In order to distract myself from my fears, I started filling the time by reading my stories to Yaltha and Lavi. Yaltha had grown increasingly quiet and morose since our arrival, downcast, it seemed, over our inability to seek Chaya, and I hoped my stories might lift her from her misery as well. They did seem to cheer her, but it was Lavi who reveled most in them. He appeared unexpectedly one day at our door. "May I bring Pamphile to hear your stories?" he said. I thought at first he'd asked because of the flair I gave to my readings. In my effort to draw Yaltha out, I'd made little performances out of them, not dancing the stories as Tabitha used to do, but enlivening them with actions and dramatic articulations. My rendition of Judith slicing off the head of Holofernes had brought gasps from Lavi and Yaltha both.
"Pamphile?" I said.
"The pretty Egyptian girl," Yaltha offered. "The house servant." I gave Lavi a knowing grin. "Go fetch her and I'll read." He dashed toward the door, then stopped. "I wish you to read the story of Rachel, whose face was more beautiful than 1,000 moons, how Jacob labored 14 years to marry her." 3. Yaltha sat in the elaborately carved chair in our sitting room, a perch she'd taken to occupying day in and day out, often with her eyes closed, her hands rubbing together in her lap while she wandered off somewhere in her thoughts. We'd been caged in Haran's house through the spring and summer, unable to visit the great library, a temple, an obelisk, or even one of the little sphinxes that perched on the harbor wall. Yaltha hadn't mentioned Chaya in weeks, but I guessed that was who she thought of while musing and fidgeting in the chair.
"Aunt," I said, unable to bear our helplessness any longer, "we came here to find Chaya. Let's do so, even if we defy Haran. First of all, child, that's not our only purpose in being here. We also came to keep you from being tossed into Herod Antipas's prison. If we stay long enough, we should at least succeed at that. As for Chaya," she shook her head and the sad, remote look returned to her face, "that is harder than I thought."
"As long as we're confined here, we'll never find her," I said. "Even if we were free to roam the city, without Haran to point us in Chaya's direction, I wouldn't know where to begin. We could ask about her in the markets, the synagogues, we could..." My words sounded pathetic even to me. "I know Haran, Anna. If we're caught venturing beyond these walls, he will make good on his word and renew the charges against me. Sometimes I think he wants me to violate his terms so he can do just that. I will be the one imprisoned, and you and Lavi will be turned onto the street. Where would you go? How would you receive word from Judas that it's safe to return?" I went to sit on the leopard skin rug at her feet, letting my cheek rest against her knee, and gazed sideways at a row of water lilies frescoed across the wall. I thought of the mud walls in Nazareth, the dirt floors, the mud and straw roof that had to be fortified against the rains. I'd never minded those humble things, but I couldn't say I missed them either. What I missed was Mary and Salome stirring pots, my goat following me around the compound, and Jesus, always Jesus. Each morning upon opening my eyes, it would break over me afresh that he was far away. I would imagine him rising from his mat and repeating the Shema, his prayer shawl draped about his shoulders as he wandered off into the hills to pray, and missing him would become so great that I too would rise, then lift my incantation bowl and sing the prayers inside it. "Sophia, breath of God, set my eyes on Egypt. Once the land of bondage, let it become the land of freedom. Deliver me to the place of papyri and ink, to the place I will be born." Knowing that we both prayed at the morning hour each day was like a tether binding us, but I lifted my bowl for another reason, too. I longed not only for him, but for myself. How, though, could anyone be born while quarantined in this house? As I sat there staring at the lilies on the wall, an idea came to me. I sat up and looked at Yaltha. If there's any reference to Chaya in this house, it could be buried somewhere in Haran's scriptorium. He has a large upright chest there. I don't know what it contains, only that he takes care to keep it locked.
I could try to search through it. If we aren't free to leave, I can at least do that. She didn't respond. Her countenance didn't change, but I could tell she was listening. Search for an adoption transaction, she said. Look for anything that might help us. 4. The next morning, when Thaddeus's eyelids thickened and his chin dropped to his chest, I slipped into Haran's study and searched for the key that unlocked the cabinet at the back of the scriptorium. I came upon it easily, poorly hidden in an alabaster jar on his desk. When I opened the cabinet, the doors screeched like lyre strings plucked wrongly, and I froze as Thaddeus roused a bit, then settled back to sleep. Hundreds of scrolls were stacked tightly into compartments, row after row, their round ends staring at me like a wall of unblinking eyes. I guessed, correctly it would turn out, that I'd discovered his personal archives. Were they arranged by subject, year, language, alphabet, or some mysterious means known only to Haran? With a glance at Thaddeus, I slid out 3 scrolls from the top left compartment and closed the cabinet without locking it. The first one was a certification in Latin of Haran's Roman citizenship. The second implored a man named Andromachus to return Haran's black female donkey that had been stolen from his stable. The third was his will, leaving all of his properties and wealth to his oldest son. Each morning thereafter, I retrieved the key and removed a handful of scrolls. Thaddeus's naps typically lasted slightly less than an hour, but fearing he might wake precipitously, I allowed myself only half that time to read, making certain to mark the outside of each document I'd completed with a small dot of ink. Long manuscripts of philosophy were mixed with letters, invitations, commemorations, and horoscopes. Nothing, it seemed, was left unrecorded. If a wee beetle ate a single leaf off a papyrus plant in his field, he wrote a lament that required the sacrifice of 3 plants. My progress was slow. At the end of 2 months, I'd read through only half the documents. "Did you find anything of interest today?" Yalva asked one afternoon when I returned to our rooms. Always the same question. Of all the emotions, hope was the most mysterious. It grew like the blue lotus, snaking up from muddy hearts, beautiful while it lasted. I shook my head. Always the same answer. "Beginning tomorrow, I'll go with you to the scriptorium," she said. "Together we can go through the scrolls much faster." This surprised, pleased, and troubled me. What if Thaddeus wakes and finds you poring over Haran's documents? It's one thing for him to find me with an unauthorized scroll. I can claim I have it by mistake, that it was misplaced. But you, he could go straight to Haran.
"Thaddeus won't be a concern."
"Why not?"
"Because we will serve him one of my special drinks."
I arrived in the scriptorium the following morning with cakes and beer, a drink the Egyptians consumed at all hours as if it were water or wine. I set a cup before Thaddeus. "We deserve refreshment, don't you think?" He tilted his head, uncertain.
"I don't know if Haran would..."
"I'm sure he won't mind, but if so, I'll tell him it was I who arranged it. You've been kind to me, and I wish to repay you, that's all." He smiled then and lifted his cup, and I felt a paroxysm of guilt. He had been kind, always treating my mistakes with patience and showing me how to repair errors by cleaning dribbles of ink with a bitter fermented liquid. I suspected he knew that I pilfered papyrus for my own purposes, yet he said nothing. And how did I repay him? I deceived him with a draft Yalva had concocted with the aid of Pamphile and a sedative distilled from the lotus flower. His oblivion was quick and miraculous. I dumped out the beer in my own cup through the window in Haran's study, and when my aunt appeared, I already had the cabinet unlocked. We unraveled scroll after scroll, securing them with reading spools, and read side by side at my desk. Yalva was an uncommonly noisy reader. She made constant vibrating sounds, hmms, oohs, and acks, suggesting she'd stumbled upon some stupefaction or frustration. We read through a dozen or so scrolls, unable to find any mention of Chaya. Yalva left at the close of an hour. That was all the time we thought we could risk. Thaddeus, however, went on sleeping. I began to stare at his inert form to be sure he was breathing. His breath seemed shallow and too far apart, and I was vastly relieved when he woke, bleary, yawning, his hair splashed up on one side of his head. He and I both pretended, as usual, not to notice that he'd been indisposed. Later, finding Yaltha back in our rooms, I said, "You and Pamphile must restrain yourselves when dousing his drink. Half the measure will do." "Do you think him suspicious of the beer?" "No, I think him well rested." 5. On a spring day, midway through the month the Egyptians called Faminoth, Yaltha and I were sitting beside the pond, she reading Homer's Odyssey, which was copied onto a thick codex, one of the more precious texts in Haran's library. I'd brought it to her with Thaddeus's permission, hoping it would fill her afternoons and distract her mind from Chaya. Our clandestine hours in the scriptorium had lasted through the fall and winter. After the first month, Yaltha limited her visits to once a week in order to ward off any suspicions Thaddeus might have. There was only so much beer we could bring him. Our efforts had also been slowed when Haran suffered a stomach ailment and did not leave the house for several weeks. Nevertheless, we'd recently finished perusing every scroll in the locked chest. We knew more about Haran's personal dealings than we cared to. Thaddeus was fat with beer, and we'd discovered nothing that suggested Chaya had ever existed. I lay back in the grasses and stared at shredded bits of cloud and wondered why Judas hadn't written to me. It normally took 3 months for a courier to bring a letter from Galilee. We'd been in Alexandria for 12. Had Judas hired an unreliable courier? Or perhaps something calamitous had happened to the courier along the way? It seemed possible Antipas had given up his search for me long ago. I dug my fingernails into the soft pad of my thumbs. Why had Jesus not sent for me? On the day my husband told me he would take up his ministry, he'd leaned his forehead against mine and closed his eyes. I tried now to picture it, to picture him. Already his features had dimmed a little in my mind. It terrified me, this slow disappearing. Pamphile stepped into the courtyard, bringing our supper. "Would you prefer to eat here in the garden?" I sat up, the image of Jesus scattering, leaving me with a sudden, sharp aloneness. "Let's eat here," Yaltha said, setting aside her book. "Has there been a letter today?" I asked Pamphile. She'd agreed to alert me to the arrival of a courier, but even so, I queried her about it daily. "I'm sorry, no." She gave me an inquisitive look. "This letter must be very important." "My brother promised to send word when it's safe for us to return to Galilee." Pamphile stopped abruptly, wobbling her tray. "Would Lavi return with you?" "We couldn't travel without his protection." I realized too late that I'd spoken without thinking. Lavi had lost his heart to her, but it seemed she'd lost hers to him as well. If she knew the letter meant Lavi's departure, would she conceal it from me? Could I trust her? She poured wine into Yaltha's cup, then mine, and handed us bowls of lentil and garlic stew. "If Lavi returns with me," I said, "I'll make certain he has money to buy passage back to Alexandria." She nodded without smiling. Yaltha frowned. I had no trouble reading her face. "I understand you wish to secure her loyalty, but will there be money for such a promise?" Other than the sum I'd set aside for our return, there were only enough drachma to pay Haran's rent for 4 more months, no more. When Pamphile had departed, Yaltha's spoon thudded against her bowl. I myself could find no appetite. I lay back once more upon the earth, closed my eyes, and searched for his face. I could not find it. 6. I pressed 5 drachma into Lavi's palm. "Go to the market and purchase a travel pouch made of wool, one that will hold my scrolls." I led him to the stone jar in my sleeping chamber, pulled out the scrolls one by one, and spread them across my bed. "As you see, our old leather pouch is no longer large enough." His eyes moved over my stockpile. "There are 27 of them," I said. Afternoon light was falling from the small window, pale green from the palms. I stared at the scrolls, at years and years of begging and scrounging for the privilege of writing, every word, every ink stroke hard won and precious, and I felt something flood through me. I don't know if I would call it pride. It was more of a simple awareness that somehow I'd done this. I felt amazed suddenly. 27 scrolls. During the year we'd been here, I'd completed my narratives of the matriarchs in the Bible, and also written an account of Chaya, the lost daughter, and Yalfa, the searching mother. I took it to my aunt before the ink had fully dried. Upon reading it, she said, "Chaya is lost, but her story isn't," and I felt that my words were a balm for her. I recreated the verses of grief for Susanna that I'd written on the pot shards I'd left behind in Nazareth. I couldn't remember all of them, but enough to satisfy me. I wrote the tale of my friendship with Phasaelis and her escape from Antipas, and finally, of the household in Nazareth. Lavi looked up from the pile of stories. "Does the new pouch mean we'll be traveling soon?" "I'm still awaiting the letter telling me it's safe to enter Galilee. I wish to be ready when it comes." I was in need of a larger pouch, it's true, but my motive in sending Lavi into the city was also ulterior. I was considering how to broach the matter when he said, "I wish to marry Pamphile." I blinked at him, startled. "And does Pamphile wish to be your wife?" "We would marry tomorrow if we could, but I have no means to care for her. I will have to find employment here in Alexandria, for she will not leave Egypt." He meant to remain here? I felt the bottom dropping from my stomach. "And when I find work," he said, "I'll make a request of her father. We can't get a license without his sanction. He's a vine dresser in the village of Dionysius. I don't know if he would give his consent to a foreigner." "I can't imagine her father would refuse you. I'll write a commendation for you if you think that would help." "Yes, thank you," he said. "I need to know, will you still return to Galilee with us? Yaltha and I cannot travel alone, it's too dangerous." "I won't abandon you, Anna," he said. Relief flowed through me, then pleasure. I didn't think he'd ever addressed me as Anna, not even after I'd pronounced him to be a free man. It seemed not just an act of friendship, but a quiet declaration of his autonomy. "Don't worry, I'll find the money for your passage back to Alexandria," I said, but the words had scarcely left me before I realized I had the money already. Letter or no letter from Judas, we had no choice but to leave when the money was depleted. We could simply depart earlier, before I was required to pay the last month's rent. The surplus would pay Lavi's passage. "Now, go quickly to the market," I said. "Go to the one near the harbor." "That is not the closest nor the largest. It would be better—" "Lavi, this is most important. I need you to also go to the harbor. Look for a ship from Caesarea. Seek out those who arrive on it. Merchants, seamen, anyone. I wish for news of Antipas. It's possible he's no longer even alive. If he's ill or dead, we can return to Galilee with peace of mind." I paced about our quarters while Yaltha read, pausing now and then to offer some commentary on Odysseus, who exasperated her by taking 10 years to get home to his wife after the Trojan War. She was no less annoyed with Penelope, who waited for him. I felt a remote kinship with Penelope. I knew a great deal about waiting for men. In the courtyard, the day was taking its leave. Lavi's knock, when it finally came, landed with faint, rapid thuds. When I opened the door, he didn't smile. He looked clenched and wary. I hadn't really expected to learn that we were free of Antipas. What was the chance the Tetrarch had died in the course of a year? But I hadn't imagined the intelligence Lavi gathered might be adverse. He removed a generously sized pouch of gray wool from his shoulder and handed it to me. The price was 3 drachma. As he settled cross-legged on the floor, I poured him a cup of Theban wine. Yaltha closed the codex, marking her place with a leather cord. The lamplight flickered and snapped. "You have news?" I said. He looked away, the hoods pulled low over his eyes. "When I got to the harbor, I went up and down the moorings. There were ships from Antioch and Rome, but none from Caesarea. I could see 3 ships beyond the lighthouse approaching, one with crimson on its sail, so I waited. As I thought, it was the Roman cargo ship from Caesarea. It carried some Jewish pilgrims returning from Passover in Jerusalem, but they wouldn't speak with me. A Roman soldier chased me. 'Lavi,' I said, 'what did you learn?'" He looked into his lap and continued. "One of the men on board didn't appear as rich as the rest. I followed him. When we were safely from the docks, I offered him the other 2 drachma in exchange for news. He was eager to take them." "Did he have word of Antipas?" I asked. "The Tetrarch is alive, and grows worse in his ways." I sighed, but the news was not unexpected. I retrieved the wine jug and refilled Lavi's cup. "There's more," he said. The prophet that Judas and your husband followed, the one Antipas imprisoned.
Yes, John the Immerser, what about him?
Antipas executed him. He cut off the Immerser's head.
His words collected in my ears and lay there, puddles of nonsense. For a minute I didn't move or speak. I heard Yaltha talking to me, but I was far away, standing in the Jordan River with John's hands lowering me beneath the water, light on the river bottom, a floor of pebbles, the silent floating. John's muffled voice calling, "Rise to newness of life." Beheaded. I looked at Lavi, a sick churning inside me. The servant you spoke with, is he certain of this?
He said the whole country spoke of the prophet's death.
Some truths seemed insoluble, stones that couldn't be swallowed.
They say Antipas's wife Herodias was behind it, Lavi added. Her daughter performed a dance that pleased Antipas so much he promised whatever she asked. At her mother's urging, she asked for John's head. I covered my mouth with my hand. The reward for a beautiful dance, a man's severed head.
Lavi watched me, his expression grave.
He said, "The servant also spoke about another prophet who was going about Galilee, preaching."
I felt my heart scurry up into my throat.
He heard the prophet preach to a great multitude on a hillside outside Capernaum. He spoke of it with awe. He said the prophet lashed out at hypocrites and proclaimed it was easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to come into the kingdom of God. He blessed the poor, the meek, the outcast, and the merciful. He preached love, saying if a soldier forces you to carry his pack 1 mile, carry it 2, and if you're struck on one cheek, turn the other one. This servant said the prophet's following is even greater than the Immersers, that people spoke of him as a Messiah, as King of the Jews. With that, Lavi fell quiet. I fell quiet, too. The wooden door onto the courtyard was flung wide onto the Egyptian night. I listened to wind shake the palm fronds, the dark, tumbling world. 7. As Yaltha parted the veils that encircled my bed, I shut my eyes, feigning sleep. It was past the midnight hour. "I know you're awake, Anna. We will talk now." She carried a beeswax candle, the light flickering under her chin and onto the bony ledge over her eyes. She rested the holder on the floor, and the choking sweetness of the wax filled my nostrils. As she squeezed beside me onto the pillows, I turned on my side, away from her. Since Lavi's news 7 days ago, I'd been unable to speak of John's gruesome death or of my terror that his fate would become my husband's. I couldn't eat. I'd slept little, and when I did, I dreamed of dead messiahs and broken threads. Jesus on the hillside, sowing his revolution. That was a good thing, and I couldn't help but feel pride in him. The purpose that had burned in him for so long was finally being realized, yet I was filled with a deep and immutable dread. At first, Yaltha left me to my silence, believing I needed time alone, but now here she was, her head on my pillow. "To avoid a fear emboldens it," she said. I said nothing. "All shall be well, child." I reared up then. "Will it? You cannot know that. How can you know that?" "Oh, Anna, Anna. When I tell you all shall be well, I don't mean that life won't bring you tragedy. Life will be life. I only mean you will be well in spite of it. All shall be well, no matter what. If Antipas kills my husband as he did John, I cannot imagine I will be well." "If Antipas kills him, you'll be devastated and grief-stricken. But there's a place in you that is inviolate. It's the surest part of you, a piece of Sophia herself. You'll find your way there when you need to. And you'll know, then, what I speak of." I laid my head against her arm, sinewy and tough like herself. I couldn't grasp what she was saying. I fell into a dreamless sleep, a black chute that had no bottom, and when I woke, my aunt was still there. As we took our breakfast the following morning, Yaltha said, "We must talk about this plan of yours to return to Galilee." She dipped her bread into the honey and pushed it into her mouth, dribbling the nectar onto her chin, and I felt my appetite return. I tore a chunk from the wheat loaf. she said, "You fear for Jesus' safety. I fear for yours." A slate of brightness had formed beside us on the floor. I gazed at it, wishing some magic scribble of light would appear telling me what to do. Returning was dangerous, perhaps as much now as when I'd first fled, but my need to see Jesus had become urgent and insurmountable. "If there's a chance Jesus is in danger," I said, "I want to see him before it's too late." She leaned forward, her eyes softening. "If you return to him now, I'm afraid it would make Antipas more inclined to snatch Jesus as well." I hadn't considered this. "You think my presence might endanger him further?" She didn't answer, but looked at me and lifted her brows. "Don't you?" 8. I'd not shown up in the scriptorium all week, but I appeared that morning resolved to carry on for now in Alexandria. I slid onto the stool at my desk, which I noticed had been cleaned, the yellow wood gleaming, smelling of citrus oil.
"You've been missed," Thaddeus commented from across the room.
I smiled at him and set to work copying a petition from a woman who asked for the tax on her grain stocks to be reduced, something about her crops failing to receive irrigation from the year's flood, a most lackluster entreaty. I was glad, though, to give my mind something to contemplate besides my own worries, and as the morning passed, I became lost in the mindless, rhythmic movement of my hand as it formed letters and words. Thaddeus stayed awake, perhaps a little animated by my return. Near noon, catching me glance at him over my shoulder, he said,
"May I inquire, Anna, what was it that you and your aunt were searching for in the scrolls?"
I stared at him dumbly. Heat shot through me. "You knew?"
"I enjoyed my sleep, and I thank you for it, but I did wake now and then, if only barely."
How much had he actually seen? It crossed my mind to tell him that Yalva had been in need of tasks to fill her time and was assisting me with my work, nothing more, but the words reached the precipice of my tongue and stalled. I didn't want to lie to him anymore. I said, "I took the key that unlocks the cabinet. We read the scrolls inside it, hoping to find some record of Yaltha's daughter." He stroked his chin, and for an awful moment I thought he might go straight to Haran. I jumped up, forcing myself to speak calmly. "I'm sorry for our deceit. I didn't wish to involve you in what we were doing in case we were discovered. Please, if you could forgive me."
"It's all right, Anna. I have no grudge against you or your aunt."
I felt myself unclench a little. "You won't report this to Haran?"
"Goodness, no. He's been no friend to me. He pays me little, then complains of my work, which I find so tedious I take naps to escape it. Your presence, though, has brought a certain liveliness."
He smiled.
"Now, what record were you seeking?"
"We sought anything that might tell us where her daughter could be. Haran gave her out for adoption." Neither Thaddeus nor any of the servants had been in Haran's employ back then. Yalva had been careful to inquire about this when we'd first arrived. I asked if he'd heard the rumors about my aunt. He nodded.
"It was said she poisoned her husband, and Haran sent her to the Therapeuti in order to save her from arrest."
"She poisoned no one," I said indignantly. "What's her daughter's name?" He inquired.
"Chaya,"
I told him. "She was 2 years old when my aunt last saw her." He squinted, tapping his fingers against his temple as if to dislodge some memory.
"That name," he muttered more to himself than to me. "I know I've seen it written somewhere."
My eyes flared wide. Was it too much to think he knew of her? He'd presided over the scriptorium and its contents for 9 years. He knew more about Haran's business than anyone. I wanted to go over and tap the other side of his head, but I remained waiting. He got up and walked in a circle about the room and had started a second loop when he stopped.
"Oh," he said.
A look passed over his face. Dismay, I thought.
"Come with me."
We slipped into Haran's study, where Thaddeus retrieved a locked wooden box that sat unobtrusively on a low shelf. It was painted on top with an image of the falcon-winged goddess Nephthys, guardian of the dead, a detail Thaddeus kindly provided. He produced a key from a peg beneath Haran's desk and slipped it into a keyhole, then lifted the lid to reveal a cluster of scrolls, perhaps 10 or 12 of them. This is where Haran conceals documents he wishes to keep secret. He sorted through the scrolls. Soon after I began working for Haran, he had me make copies of all the scrolls in the box. If I remember rightly, there's a death notice in here of a girl named Chaya. Hers was an unusual name. It remained with me. The blood left my head. She's dead? I sank down into Haran's grand chair, taking a slow breath as Thaddeus opened a papyrus on the table before me. To the royal scribe of the metropolis from Haran ben Philip Levias of the Jewish Council. I attest that Chaya, daughter of my sister Yaltha, died in the month of Apif of the 32nd year of the Emperor Augustus Caesar. As her guardian and kinsman, I request that her name be entered among those who have died. She is not default in the payment of taxes, being the age of 2 years at the time of her death. I read the notation twice, then pushed it back to Thaddeus, who perused it quickly. He said, "The laws do not require notification of the death of a child, only of an adult male who is taxable. It's done, but rarely. I recall thinking it odd." Chaya is dead. I tried to picture myself standing before Yaltha saying the words, but even in my imagination I couldn't say them. He replaced the scroll and locked the box. "I'm sorry, but it's best to know the truth." So shocked was I, so choked with dread at passing on this horrific news, I wasn't at all sure knowing was best. Right then I preferred to go on living in uncertainty, imagining Chaya alive somewhere. I found Yaltha walking about the garden. I watched her from the doorway for a while, then strode toward her trying to steady myself. As we sat at the edge of the pond, I told her about the death notification. She looked at the sky, where there was not a bird or a cloud, then dropped her chin to her chest as a sob broke from her lips. I wrapped my arms about her caved-in shoulders, and we sat like that for a long time, quiet and dazed, listening to the garden. Birds chirping, the rustle of lizards, a tiny zephyr in the palms. 9. Days passed in which Yaltha sat and stared into the garden through the open door of the sitting room. I woke one night to check on her, and there she was, gazing out at the dark. I didn't disturb her. She was grieving in her own way. I returned to bed where sleep came, and with it a dream. A great wind rises. The air fills with scrolls. They fly about me like white and brown birds. Looking up, I see the falcon goddess Nephthys streak across the sky. I woke with the dream still in my body, filling me with lightness, and what came into my mind was the wooden box in which Haran stored his secret documents. It was as if in my dream Nephthys had escaped from her confinement on the lid, as if the box had been thrown open and all the scrolls set free. I lay very still and tried to remember everything about those moments when Thaddeus showed me the box, the key, the creak in the lid as he lifted it, the cluster of scrolls inside, reading the death notice twice. Then in my memory I heard Thaddeus say, "The laws do not require notification of the death of a child, only of an adult male who is taxable. It's done, but rarely. I recall thinking it odd." The statement had seemed irrelevant at the time, but I wondered now why my uncle had taken the extra precaution of declaring Chaya dead if it wasn't required. Why had it been so important to record it? And something else came back to me. She'd only been 2 when she'd died. Was it not strange that her life had ended so soon after Yaltha had been sent away? I bolted up. I was waiting in the scriptorium when Thaddeus arrived. "I must look once more inside the locked box in Haran's study," I told him. He shook his head. "But you've seen the death notice. What more is there?" I thought better than to tell him about the dream or my feeling that something was amiss. I said, "My uncle has already left to conduct his business in the city. It will be safe enough." "It's not Haran I'm worried about, but his personal servant, the one with the shorn head." I knew which one he meant. He was said to grovel before Haran, as well as snoop for him. Anything to ingratiate himself. "We'll be quick," I promised, and gave him my most pleading look. He sighed and led me to the study. I counted 9 scrolls inside the box. I unraveled one and read a harsh repudiation of Haran's second wife for failing in her oath of fidelity. The second scroll was a settlement of their divorce. Thaddeus watched me, his eyes roving toward the door. I don't know what you're looking for, but it would be prudent to read faster. I didn't know what I was looking for either. I smoothed open a third scroll, anchoring it on the desk. Chuayak, son of Dias and a keeper of camels in the village of Soknapayo. His wife having died and left him toil and suffering, does hand over his 2-year-old daughter, Diadora, to a priest of the Temple of Isis for the sum of 1,400 silver drachma. I stopped reading. My mind began to reel a little. Have you come upon something? He asked. There's mention of a 2-year-old girl. He started to question me further, but I held up my hand, signaling him to wait as I continued to read. The purchaser, who is granted anonymity by virtue of his status as a representative of the goddess of Egypt, receives Diadora into his legal ownership, and from this day will possess, own, and have proprietary rights over the girl. Chuayak henceforth has no power to take back his daughter, and through this sale agreement, written in 2 copies, gives his consent and acknowledges payment. Signed on behalf of Chuayak, who knows no letters, by Haran ben Philip Levias, this day in the month of Apif, in the 32nd year of the reign of the illustrious Emperor Augustus Caesar. I lifted my head. Heat crept from my neck into my face, a kind of astonishment. Sophia, I whispered. What is it? What does it say? The 2-year-old belonged to a man named Chuayak, a destitute father whose wife died. He sold his daughter as a slave to a priest. I glanced again at the document. The girl's name was Diadora. I rummaged in the box for Chaya's death certificate and placed the 2 documents side by side. 2-year-old Chaya, 2-year-old Diadora. Chaya died and Diadora was sold in the same month of the same year. I didn't know if Thaddeus had arrived at the same supposition as I had. I didn't take the time to inquire. 10. I found Yaltha napping soundly in the chair beside the door to the courtyard, her mouth open and her hands folded high on her chest. I knelt in front of her and softly called her name. When she didn't rouse, I gave her knee a shake. She opened her eyes, frowning, her forehead wrinkling up. "Why did you wake me?" she said, sounding annoyed. "Aunt, it is good news. I found a document that may give us a reason to hope Chaya is not dead." She sat straight up. Her eyes were suddenly bright and churning. "What are you talking about, Anna?" "Please don't let me be wrong." I told her about my dream and the questions it had stirred, compelling me to return to Haran's study and reopen the box. As I described the document I'd found inside it, she stared at me, mystified. I said, "The girl who was sold into bondage had the name Diadora, but don't you think it's peculiar that both Chaya and Diadora were the same age? That one died and the other sold as a slave in the same month of the same year?" Yaltha closed her eyes. "They are the same girl." The certainty in her voice startled me. It impelled and excited me, too. "Think of it," I said. "What if it wasn't some poor camel keeper who sold a 2-year-old girl to the priest, but Haran himself?" She gazed at me with sad, stunned wonder. "And afterward," I continued, "Haran concealed what he'd done with a notice of Chaya's death. Does this seem possible to you? I mean, do you think him capable of this?" "I think him capable of anything. And he would have good reason to cover up the deed. The synagogues here condemn selling Jewish children into slavery. Haran would be removed from the council if this was discovered. He could be cast out of the community altogether." "Haran wanted people to believe Chaya was dead, and yet he told you she'd been adopted. I wonder why. Do you think he wanted you to leave Alexandria believing she was loved and cared for? Maybe there's a speck of kindness in him somewhere." Her laugh was bitter. "He knew how anguishing it would be for me to have a daughter out there who is lost to me. He knew it would haunt me all my days. When my sons died, the grief was an agony, but with time I reconciled myself to it. I've never reconciled myself to losing Chaya. One moment she seems within reach, and the next moment she's in an abyss I can never find. Haran was pleased to offer me this special brand of torture." Yaltha leaned back in the chair, and I watched her anger fade and her eyes soften. she let out an extravagant breath. "Did the document record the name of the priest who bought the girl or what temple he served?" she asked. It mentioned neither. "Then Chaya could be anywhere in Egypt, here in Alexandria, or as far as Philae." Finding her suddenly seemed impossible. I could tell by the disappointment in my aunt's face that she thought so too. She said, "It's enough that Chaya is alive." But of course, it wasn't. 11. One morning shortly after I'd arrived in the scriptorium, Haran's servant appeared at the door. He made a little bow in my direction. "Haran wishes to see you in his study." During the many months we'd been here, I'd never been summoned by Haran. In fact, I'd rarely seen him, having passed him no more than 24 times as I moved between the scriptorium and the guest quarters. I'd paid his rent requirements to Apion. It's a curiosity how the mind alights first on the worst scenario. I immediately thought Haran must have discovered I'd been prying into his locked cabinet and box of secrets. Wheeling about on my stool, I looked at Thaddeus, who seemed as surprised and disconcerted as I. "Shall I come with you?" he asked. "Haran asked only for the woman," the servant said, shifting about impatiently. My uncle sat in his study, elbows propped on his desk, one fist balled into the other. He glanced up at me, then refocused his attention on an array of scrolls, pens, and ink vials scattered around him, making me wait. I didn't think his servant had seen my intrusions, but I couldn't be sure. I replanted my feet. Minutes passed. "Thaddeus tells me your work is satisfactory," he said. Finally. "As such, I've decided to waive your rent requirement. You may stay for now as guests, not boarders." Guests, prisoners, there was little difference. "Thank you, Uncle." I tried to smile at him. It helped immensely that he had a dab of ink on the side of his nose, which he'd placed there with his smudged finger. He cleared his throat. "I leave tomorrow to inspect my papyrus crops and workshops. I travel to Terranuthis, Letopolis, and Memphis, and expect to be away for 4 weeks." We'd been shut up in this house for nearly a year and a half, but here it was, sweet freedom. It was all I could do to keep from breaking into song and dance. "I've bidden you here," he said, "to advise you in person that my absence does not change our agreement. If you or my sister leave the house, you will forfeit your right to remain here, and I will have no choice but to renew the charge of murder against you. I've instructed Apion to watch you. He will report your movements to me." Sweet, sweet, sweet freedom. Finding no trace of Yaltha in our rooms, I hurried to the servants' quarters where she sometimes retreated. I found her there with Pamphil and Lavi, hunched over a game of Senet, moving her ebony pawn over the board, trying to be the first player to pass into the afterlife. The game had become a salve, a way to distract herself, but her disappointment about finding Chaya still hung over her like a small cloud I could almost see. "Ah!" my aunt cried, landing on a square that symbolized bad fortune. "I'm in no hurry for you to reach the afterlife," I said, and the three of them looked around, surprised to see me. My aunt grinned. "Not even this paltry afterlife on the game board?" "Not even that one." I slipped beside her and whispered, "I have welcome news." She flipped her pawn onto its side. "Since Anna has requested that I not visit the afterlife today, I must withdraw from the game." I led her to a private spot near the outdoor kitchen and told her what had just transpired. The corners of her mouth twitched. "I've been thinking. There's one person who would have known about Haran's deception, and that's Apion's father, Apollonius. He was Haran's treasurer before Apion, but also his confidant, doing his bidding. It's likely he was involved in the matter." "Then we'll go and find him." "He will be old now," she said, "if he's alive at all." "Do you think he would help us?" "He was always kind to me." "I'll approach Apion when the time is right," I told her, and watched her tilt back her head and drink in the spaciousness of the sky. 12. Apion was in the small room he called the treasury, writing numbers onto a piece of lined parchment. He looked up at my approach.
If you've brought money for your rent, Haran has done away with the requirement.
Yes, he told me himself. I'm here to ask for the favor you owe me. I tried to look modest, to be the kind of genial person one is eager to grant favors. He sighed audibly and laid down his pen. I understand my uncle has placed Yalfa and me under your watchful eye while he's away. I would like to respectfully request that you forego this onerous task and leave us to ourselves.
If you plan to venture out of the house against Haran's wishes and expect me to say nothing to him, you are mistaken. It puts me at risk of losing my position.
It seems taking undisclosed bribes also puts you at risk, I said.
He rose from the table. His dark curls glittered with oil. I caught the scent of myrrh. You threaten me, then.
I only ask that you look the other way while Haran is away. My aunt and I have been here more than a year and have seen nothing of the greatness of Alexandria. Are a few excursions too much to ask? I don't wish to go to Haran about the bribes you took from me, but I will.
He studied me, seeming to weigh my threat. I doubted I would follow through with it, but he didn't know that. I held his gaze. He said, I'll ignore your goings and comings, but once Haran has returned, my debt to you will be paid. You must give me an oath you will extort me no further.
Extort is a harsh word, I said.
It's also the correct word. Now swear before me that your uncle's return will be the end of it.
I swear it.
He sat down again, dismissing me with a flick of his wrist. I said,
May I ask, is your father still living?
He looked up. My father? Why is this of interest to you?
You may recall that when I first met you in Sepphoris.
He interrupted, his mouth tightening. Do you mean back when you were with child? It took a moment to realize what he meant. I'd forgotten the lie I'd told him. Clearly, he had not. When I'd pretended I was pregnant in order to obtain from him what I needed, I hadn't known I'd be traveling to Alexandria, where the months would reveal my falsehood. I felt an embarrassed heat on my cheeks. Are you going to lie again and tell me you lost the child?
No. I confess I lied to you. I'll not do so again. I'm sorry.
I was sorry, and yet my lie had helped win us passage to Alexandria, and my extortion, as he insisted on calling it, now offered us the freedom to roam about the city. Yes, I was sorry, and no, I was not sorry. He nodded, his shoulders dropping. My words seemed to mollify him. I began again. As I was about to say, when we first met, I mentioned that my aunt had known your father. She was fond of him, and asked me to inquire of his health.
Tell her he's well enough, though he's grown corpulent in his old age. He lives on a diet of beer, wine, bread, and honey.
Apollonius is alive. If by chance Yaltha wished to see him, how would she find him?
I don't wish to give you another reason to stray from the house, but it seems you plan to do so anyway. My father can be found at the library, where he goes each day to join the enclave of men who sit in the colonnades and debate exactly how far God is from the world. 1,000 eiders, or 7 times 1,000.
They think God far?
They are Platonists and Stoics, and followers of the Jewish philosopher Philo. I hardly know what they think.
This time, when he flicked his wrist, I left.
13. I moved along the canopic way as if thrust from a bough, flying ahead of Yalfa and Lavi, and then having to pause for them to catch up. In the center of the street, narrow pools of water cascaded one into the other for as far as I could see, and hundreds of copper pots filled with kindling lined the sides, waiting to be set afire at night to light the thoroughfare. The women were clad in blue, black, or white tunics cinched under their breasts with bright-colored ribbons, making me conscious of my plain Nazareth dress, dingy, undyed flax. As they passed, I studied their coiled silver snake bracelets, hoop earrings with dangling pearls, their eyes lined in green and black, hair swept into knots atop their head with a row of curls on their foreheads. I pulled my long single braid over my shoulder and held on to it as if it were the end of a tether. Nearing the royal quarter, I spied my first obelisk,
a tall, narrow structure that jutted toward the sky. I craned my head back and studied it.
"It's a monument to a particular part of the male body," Yaltha said, perfectly serious. I looked at it again and heard Lavi laugh, then Yaltha. I didn't say so, but I'd had no trouble believing her jest.
"They are more useful as timekeepers," she said, inspecting the long, bright black shadow the obelisk cast. "It's 2 hours past noon. We've tarried long enough."
We'd set out at midday, leaving quietly through the servant quarters when no one was about. Lavi had insisted on accompanying us. Aware of our mission, he shouldered a pouch containing the last of our money in case it became necessary to bribe Apollonius. Lavi had constantly implored me to slow down, and once had steered us across the street when a legation of officious-looking Roman men approached. I looked at him now, thinking of him and Pamphile. They seemed no closer to realizing their plans to marry than when he had first told me about